WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In 1987, writer John Gregory Dunn's doctor told him that he was a prime candidate for a heart attack. During a checkup, the doctor had found a critical lesion on a main artery. This scare set Dunn off reflecting on his life, and many of those reflections wound up in his new memoir, Harp. Harp is a derogatory term for an Irish Catholic. Dunn says he chose it because it's short, sharp, and abusive. Dunn is himself Irish Catholic, but he's a writer who's never afraid to be unpleasant. Dunn is a former staff writer for Time magazine. In 1969, he began writing fiction and realized the wealth of material available to him in his own Irish-American background. His novels include Vegas, True Confessions, Dutch Shay Jr., and The Red, White, and Blue. Since the mid-60s, he's been married to the writer Joan Didion. They've collaborated on screenplays for the films Panic in Needle Park, Play It As It Lays, the remake of A Star Is Born, and an adaptation of Dunn's novel True Confessions, which starred Robert De Niro and Robert Duvall. After the diagnosis of his heart condition, John Gregory Dunn had an angioplasty and has avoided open-heart surgery. I asked him what surprised him the most about his reaction to having a life-threatening condition.
I had never really been introspective before, and I think that if a doctor tells you that you're a candidate for a catastrophic event, it tends to focus your mind wonderfully. And you wonder who I am and how I got here. And so it was as a result of that that I began sort of thinking not about my life so much, but about the writer's life. This book was never meant to be a book. It was meant to be the introduction to a book of essays. And I was going to have an introduction of approximately 6,000 words, which is about 25 pages. And I began writing it, and it just got longer. And when I reached approximately 100 pages of manuscript, my wife said, "No, this is a book." I said, no, I can't even think of it that way. Otherwise, I'll just freeze up and not do it. And but by the time I got to be 150, 175 pages, even I knew that it was a book. But if I had thought of it as a book, the structure wouldn't have been as free form as it is in the book as it now stands. And I don't think I could have written it.
When you were having the heart problems and seeing doctors, did you try to impress your doctors that you were something special and they'd better really do a good job with you?
you do this thing. It came about accidentally. I was having an annual physical, and I had an EKG, and the doctor, I was still buckled up with all the leads were still clamped to my chest, and the doctor said, "You have a glitch." And before he even took the clamps off, he called a cardiologist and had a meeting with me and set up an appointment for me that afternoon. And so I went, and I think you try to explain to the doctor, "Listen, I'm something special. You better bring all your talent to bear on me. I mean, I don't want to check out. I've got a lot of things I have to do." I think everyone feels that way, that he is special, he or she is special.
I thought it was funny the way you really found confidence in bragging about your doctors to other people, even in talking about, like, the great Jim Dine prints
that they
had on the
that's
wall.
That's right. The doctors were specialists in this procedure called balloon angioplasty, and I had done so many that they were asked to lecture all over the world, and I thought, well, you know, these guys are really good. And on the walls, they actually had very good prints on the walls, and they had Jim Dine prints, and I heard myself saying to a nurse one day, I actually know Jim and Nancy, and she looked at me as if I were bonkers. And then you sort of see. The thought occurs to you that you might die, and you sort of see omens every place. I remember one day I was sort of I was putting Susan Sontag's telephone number in my I have a computer telephone book, and I was putting her number in it, and I lost the entire telephone book. through some sort of computer error. Well, Susan had written the book Illness and Metaphor. I thought that means that I'm going to die. That is the metaphor. The next day, through some fluke, I was able to refine her telephone number. And so I said, now I'm going to live. But you have the sense of this is the last time I will go to Dodger Stadium. This is the last time I will go to this restaurant. This is the last time I'll buy a suit. Should I even buy a suit? I wouldn't even answer letters because I was afraid that if I did die, it would be too creepy for someone to receive a letter that I had sent before I did die.
When you were experiencing all this, would you go through a reaction and then measure your response and say, is this response worthy of something I'd write in fiction, or is this a cliched response unworthy of the person who I am?
What I always knew was that this was really good material. And a writer is always sort of trolling for material. And so the first thing I did was open up a file which was called CAD, coronary artery disease, also CAD, which I thought sometimes people think I am. And it was, I knew that everything, including the Jim Dine prints and the doctor's walls and the sort of nurse ratchet when I checked into the hospital, that all this stuff was really good material. I think all writers are so detached they see everything as a possible source of material.
My guest is John Gregory Dunn, and his new book is a series of autobiographical pieces. It's called Harp. You write about your encounter with possible death through heart problems. You write about the actual deaths of people in your family, the suicide of your brother, and the murder of your niece, Dominique Dunn, who is the daughter of your brother, the writer Dominic Dunn. And you explain you didn't go to the murder trial, and you even tried to convince your brother Dominic not to go, and that you'd like to think that if it had been your daughter who was murdered, that you wouldn't have gone to the trial. Why were you so opposed to attending the murder trial?
Well, I've been to so many murder trials, and essentially, I'd been to so many murder trials which I'd covered as a reporter or just gone out of writer's interest. And I knew that in any murder trial, the victim is always put on trial. And shortly before the trial began. I had dinner one night with an old friend of mine, David Halberstam, and David's brother had been murdered the year before. And he said to me, are you going to go to the trial? And I said, my instinct is not to. And he said, don't. He said, because, he said, the person they're going to talk about up there bears no relation to person who you know. And in most murder trials, the victim is made a co-conspirator in her own murder. And it was just awful thinking of that. Then there was an additional thing, which I did not put in the book. My wife and I were both on the witness list, as was my daughter. And we had reason to suspect, good reason, that we would be called as hostile witnesses by the defense. And we wanted no part of that, and so we left.
Your brother Dominic not only attended the trial but reported on it for Vanity Fair. What was your reaction to his reporting on it?
It was intensely moving. My feeling about that is I don't wish to impose my view on anyone else. I just don't want to I don't want to be a part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
I don't find it cathartic.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask you, since you've written about the death of people in your family and your own fear of death when you found out about, you know, the heart problems you were having, I was wondering if you now think of yourself as being more obsessively absorbed when that kind of period comes over you about your own death or about the possible death of people close to you. Do you know
about
what I mean?
I think everybody goes
through these periods of, like, really getting involved with thinking about death.
I think one of the oddest things about this whole experience is that I used to be terrified of my own death.
Uh-huh.
I am less so now. I am terrified about the death of loved ones, but not really about my own.
Why are you less worried about your own death
now? I think because once you brush mortality or have a brush with mortality, that you... it's not that you don't... It's not that it's not bad, but it's no longer unknown. And I think it's the unknown that is terrifying.
Do you ever get very irrational in your fears of the death of others?
Not irrational. I just sometimes. I mean, if I hear the telephone ring at 3 o'clock in the morning, I get. I hate to pick it up because there's nothing good that can come from a telephone call at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's either going to be a drunk or a hang up or a wrong number or something like that, or it's going to be bad news. That's how I got the news of my brother's suicide. That's how I got the news of my niece's murder. And so if I hear the telephone ring at 4 o'clock in the morning now, I just cannot make myself pick up the phone.
But you will pick up the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. In your new book, Harp, you write that your motto is get mad and get even. And you say, although it is not necessary for a writer to be an expletive, neither does it hurt, resentment sharpens his eye, hostility hones his killer instinct. Is this a persona or is this a philosophy for you about writing?
I think essentially it is a philosophy. I think most writers are outsiders. Writing itself is an astonishingly hostile and aggressive act. I mean, you can cover up the writing with subordinate clauses and make it flowery, et cetera, and so forth. But what you are saying to the reader is, this is how I view things. I want you to view things my way. And no matter how nice you make the writing, you are still imposing yourself and your view of things on the reader. So it starts off being a very hostile and aggressive act. Then I think that writers are essentially outsiders, that they find their material where it, everything they see is a source of material, and their nose is always pressed up against the window on the other side of which usually is their material. And I think it is that being an outsider that makes it hostile. Makes you hostile.
You talk about writing being a hostile and aggressive act, and I'm reminded of the fact that you say when you go to someone's house, you always examine their medicine chest and see what kind of pills they're taking, so you can find out what's up with them.
Well, I think that you can find... I mean, this is when I do visit... Now, obviously, I have blown my cover,
dinner invitations, right?
And so, but you can find entire social and sexual and personal histories in someone's needless to say, medical histories in someone's medicine chest. I always used to look in the medicine chest, and it's amazing that since I wrote that, the number of people who have come up to me and whispered that they do too.
Well, how much of a license to be a snoop does writing give you, do you think?
I think it gives you total license, but I think that if you get caught, you have to pay the penalty.
My guest is writer John Gregory Dunn. He has a new book. It's a series of autobiographical pieces called Harp. One of the things that you did after you got over your heart problems was to go to Ireland, and you're of Irish Catholic descent,
mm-hmm.
and describe your family as having gone from steerage to suburbia in three generations.
Mm-hmm.
But that, on the other hand, you never really related much to being Irish Catholic till you were in your 40s.
That's not quite true. I never related to being Irish. Irish from Ireland. My Irishness was a component of parochial school and of priests and nuns, but not of the place called Ireland. And I never really had any interest in going to the place called Ireland. And then, after this medical experience, I decided to go to Ireland to see if I could track down my grandfather's birth records. He had come from Ireland in the late 1860s as a young boy, and so I was sort of interested in finding out where he came from, and indeed if I had any Irish relatives in Ireland. And so I went there in a kind of quest, a kind of holy grail, and just ran up against a brick wall. And it, I found nothing in the town where he was said to have been born. There, I had checked all the baptismal records, because there were no civil records kept in Ireland until in the late 1860s. And he'd been born in 1857. And so... So I checked all the baptismal records, and I ran up against a brick wall.
Did going to Ireland give you a sense of a deeper connection to the country than you'd felt before? Did
No.
you still feel disconnected from it?
Yes. The enduring feeling I had from it was how beautiful it was.
Mm-hmm.
I was there in early June. There was no rain. It was very sunny. I went to the west coast of Ireland, and I don't think I've ever seen a more beautiful place, maybe in northern New Mexico. I mean, it was absolutely gorgeous.
But that's different from feeling connection to the country.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't want to force that feeling.
That's right.
Yeah. I've read about you that you stuttered as a child.
Still do.
Oh, well, you're certainly not right now. But I was wondering how, I was going to ask you how you got over it. Maybe you think you didn't, although, you know, you really sound quite good.
Well, you get over it because you set up a kind of distant early warning system, you know, that there are certain letters and certain words that you would stumble over. And so you prepare detours around the minefields of speech. I've always thought that I don't like to listen to a tape of myself because I notice a very odd herky-jerky cadence in the way I talk. And the reason for that is I anticipate that I'm going to stammer over something. And so find a synonym and, you know, do something to, as I said, to detour around the minefields of speech.
Mm-hmm. So you still feel a little self-conscious about speaking
Absolutely.
Publicly?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you a little bit about being a two-writer family. Your wife is the writer, Joan Didion. And I don't know if you read or edit each other's work, but I wonder if you feel that to really know each other fully, that you have to read everything that the other person wrote.
I don't know if you have to know someone if you have to read what he or she wrote. We just do, and we always have. Joan and I were friends for 6 or 7 or 8 years before we began keeping company, and so this is a long-standing process with us. The only thing we do together is a motion picture screenplay. But when we are working on a prose piece, we do show each other the things that we are working on, and because we are so close to each other, we give each other very much more acute advice, I think, than a normal editor would give, because we know how the other thinks, and we think we know where the work is going, and so we can say, why don't you do this, why don't you do that? And I am forever grateful for the advice that she has given me, and I think that she would say the same about me.
I don't know how you are in accepting criticism or how she is, but it's sometimes not easy to accept criticism, no matter how accurate you realize it is. Does that kind of editing process and the criticism ever get in the way of...
Not really, no. I mean, I used to be... Joan would never sort of say anything directly to me, but I knew that if she didn't meet my eye, that she didn't like what she had read. When she talked to me, when I was younger, I used to say something was junk, or that she missed the point, which I wouldn't say now. But now I wouldn't have to. I would say I don't think this is working, and why don't you do X, Y, or Z? And that's never really been a problem.
You've collaborated together on screenplays. Are you writing any more screenplays?
Just finished one.
Of what?
It's an original or a quasi-original screenplay for Disney, and it's about a young woman who gets out of college and goes to work in TV, and it's about the years when she's in local TV stations, and it ends with her getting the call to the network.
Do you know who's going to be in it?
Oh, no, it just finished. Mm-hmm. Just finished yesterday.
You once made the observation that you can never tell from a screenplay if a movie's going to be any good, because some of the best screenplays have been developed into some of the worst movies, and vice versa. Do you find that very frustrating when you write a screenplay?
No, it's one of the givens of making movies. I've said many times that that the best a screenwriter can hope to be in the process is a co-pilot. Those are just decisions over which you have no control.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you'll be writing a memoir again?
Never.
Why not?
I've done it, and the next time I won't be able to fool myself that I'm not doing it. The only reason I was able to continue on this one was that I was still thought of it as an introduction. I don't think I would ever do anything formal again.
Is there fallout from writing a memoir that you don't like?
No.
Okay.
No. I just don't think that my life has been all that interesting, and it's just what you make of it.
Right. So how's your health now?
Terrific.
What's the prognosis with your heart?
Good. Everything's fine. I've had a series of tests. Everything's fine.
Great. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and your writing. Thank you.
Thank you.